This lecture, entitled The Consolidation of Reform Judaism, Rabbinic Assemblies of Frankfurt and Breslau, is dedicated to the memory Le'iloi Nishmas of Chaim David ben Harav Peretz Olav HaShalom, Mr. David Weiss, of blessed memory. In the previous lectures, we traced the roots of both the Torah Sheval Peh, the oral law, which according to the historical records of the Talmud, was given to Moshe hand in hand together with the Torah Shebiksav, the written Torah, and we traced as well the whole corpus of rabbinic law. Before we continue on with the history of the Reform movement within Judaism, we'd first like to clarify, based upon Talmudic sources, the parameters that halakhic authorities were actually given to modify both Torah and rabbinic law in special circumstances. In other words, to what extent, if any, do the authorities have the flexibility to change Torah law or previous rabbinic legislation? I'd like to begin here on page 1 of the handouts. Reish Lakish said, what is the meaning of the verse? This is in Genesis 5. This is the book of the generations of Adam. So that's Sefer Tolus Adam. Did Adam have a book? What it implies is that the Holy One, blessed be He, showed to Adam, every, it's only a hint, of course, the simple meaning of the text is this is relating the generations of man. But the fact the use of the word Sefer, where it's not used anyplace else, describing the generations, is hinting at the following. What it implies, the Holy One, blessed be He, showed to Adam every coming generation with its expositors, Dorshov, or seekers of God, every generation with its sages, every generation with its leaders. In other words, every generation is given special leaders to deal with its unique circumstances and challenges. One example is the following. And on paragraph B, we quote the Gemara in Chulin. This is in Vavam Bezayin Omed Aleph. Shua ben Zoraz, the son of Rameir's father-in-law, testified before his Rabbi Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, Rabbi Yehuda the prince, that Rabbi Meir ate a leaf of a vegetable in Beit Shon without tithing it. In other words, the Torah mandates that one has to give tithes from grain, from the wine, from the olives, the olive oil. There is a question as to whether the Torah demanded also to give from other fruits, from the trees. What's definite, though, is that vegetables, yerokos, are only required to be tithed rabbinically. Now, in Eretz Yisrael, in Israel itself, actually the land of Israel, there's a requirement to tithe vegetables. In the surrounding areas, Ammon, Moab, Mitzrayim, Bovel, those areas, which our rabbis also legislated that the tithes should not be forgotten and tithes be taken. Tithes were taken only on the essentials. But vegetables were not required to be taken in areas outside of Eretz Yisrael. With other things, yes, but not vegetables. Yerokos. There was testimony given to Rabbi, assumed this is a very reliable person, Rabbi Yeshua ben Zoraz, said that he had witnessed Rabbi Meir eating the vegetables in Beit Shon without tithing. Evidently, Rabbi Meir understood that this area was not part of the original Eretz Yisrael. Let me just add the following. There was the greater Eretz Yisrael, which its boundaries are delineated in the Torah, which eventually was conquered. And all that area, the laws of tithes applied to it. after the destruction of the temple, the conquest by the Chaldeans, the Babylonians, it was understood that sanctity no longer existed, the original sanctity of the land. It had to be re-sanctified. And during the period in the time of Ezra, in the Second Commonwealth, it was re-sanctified. However, the boundaries of the area of re-sanctification were not as extensive as the original sanctification. Beit Shan was part of the original Eretz Yisrael, part of the original sanctification, but the question was it included in the re-sanctification? Because they didn't sanctify all of Eretz Yisrael. So, based on this testimony, evidently he understood, Rabbi Meir understood, this was not part of the re-sanctification, and therefore, since it was in the tithes that were taken were the tithes that were given to areas outside of Israel, vegetables were not included. Therefore, Rabbi Yehuda Nasi permitted the entire territory of Beit Shan. Thereupon, his brothers and other members of his father's family combined to protest, saying, "The place which was regarded as subject to tithes by your parents and ancestors, were you regard as free?" In other words, at least the tithes of vegetables. So Rabbi thereupon expounded to them the following verse. This is a story that, and he, Hizkiyahu, the king, broke in pieces the brazen serpent that Moses had made. You know, there's a story, the Torah relates that the Jews in their wanderings, there was a plague of serpents, and Moses created this serpent that was on, that was raised up high. It was a place for prayer. And that serpent, the thing, was preserved. This copper serpent was preserved. And the people as a whole, the masses of people, ascribed to it certain supernatural powers and worshipped it. Chizkiyo destroyed it. Broken pieces, the brazen serpent that Moses had made. For unto those days the children of Israel did offer to it. Doesn't say how many, of course, but it was a source of stumbling. And it was called Nechushtan, from Nechoshes, from Kapath. That's the quote. Now, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi argued, now, is it all likely that Asa did not destroy it? Yehoshaphat did not destroy it? So Asa and Yehoshaphat destroyed every form of idolatry in the world. In other words, the world meaning, of course, of their area under their kingship, they destroyed all idolatry. Why wasn't that destroyed? Must therefore be that his ancestors left something undone whereby he, Chizkiyo, might distinguish himself. The Meforshim explained, also in Yehoshaphat, reason that since Moses had done this, it had a certain sanctity and they were reluctant to destroy it. Chizkiyo determined, his determination, it was not worth the cost, and he destroyed it. In a certain sense, if Chizkiyo is right, they should have done this before. Evidently, it says that Hashem left room for Chizkiyo to have his contribution. Every generation needs its contribution. So in my case, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi continued, my ancestors left room for me to distinguish myself. In other words, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, based upon what he felt to be reliable testimony, saw fit to change the status quo in Beit Shan and relieve its farmers and populace of the burden of tithing its vegetables. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi's ruling did not affect the tithings of other produce, as we explained. In addition, as the Gemara points out, during the seventh or Shemitah year, when throughout much of Israel the poor have to compete with the general populace in gathering food from the unattended fields, Beit Shan, which now would be considered outside of Israel, would now join the other outlying communities where cultivation was allowed and a special tithe for the poor, Maitzer Oni, was distributed to them. So there was a benefit for him declaring it not not Israel with the sanctity of Eretz Yisrael. But the power of the rabbinate, at least during the period when all came together as united voice in the Sanhedrin, the highest court, was not only to interpret halacha law, to legislate new law by making takonis or gzeris, new ordinances and decrees, but also to modify under certain circumstances the existing laws as we now read. Now, the case of Rebbe, his leadership, was what he determined was a mistake from a previous generation. Right, but that was what from Rebbe, as he felt that the previous generation was mistaken, and he felt Beishon. This now we're dealing with making changes. And again, just to be as a hagdama, just a preface to this. This is taken from a Gemara in Yevamos, Teitesam and Beis Sadia Medalev, Teitesam Medalev. There's a we spoke about the requirement of tithing. Really, there are steps in the tithing. First, truma is given, that's given to the Kohanim. And then the first tithe is given, that is given to the Levites. And then there's a second tithe, depending on the year, either it's taken up to Jerusalem or it's redeemed and the money is taken up to Jerusalem or it's distributed to the poor. And when truma is given, and it's given to the Kohanim, one has to be careful that first of all, what is given or what is tithed has to be of superior quality. You don't say, well, the worst I'll give, you know, as a tax write-off. Just, you know, I'll give as to the Kohanim. But not only just in general quality, but there are two types of truma. There's two types of that which is given to the Kohanim. One is truma tahora, it's ritually pure, and it can be consumed by them. And there's truma tamea, which is ritually unclean. They're allowed to use it as fuel, they can burn it for fuel, but they can't eat it. So imagine the scenario that a person has some truma tamea, has produce which is tamei, which is on, has produce which is ritually pure. He says, you know what, I might as well get rid of that which is tamei. And he says, this will be, if it's separated, this will be, this tamei dika, you know, this tamei produce will be now the truma given to the Kohanim, and therefore the rest will be for me. Because you're really giving something which is inferior. Now if you give that to the Kohen, that which is tamei, he can't eat it. He can only just burn it for fuel. You're not allowed to do so. It's against even Torah law. You're not allowed to do so. So that this is this is the preface. We learned in Trumas, chapter 2, this is Mishnah 2, Truma, this is from Tomei, ritual unclean produce may not be set apart for that which is ritually clean. In other words, I'll give the inferior. If, however, such truma had been set apart, it is valid if the act was done in error. In other words, it was given. You violated it, but it's given. But if it was done willfully, it is null and void. And there's a question, what does it mean, null and void? Now, from Chizda replied, the act is absolutely null and void. Even that griva, means measure, which has been designated as truma, returns to its former state of tevel. In other words, even by Torah law, it's valid. Rabbinically, they revoked his power of making truma, and it's as if it never occurred. It's as if the Rabbanan interfered with the Torah and said, we're not going to let this happen. Rabbi Nosson, son of Rabbi Osher, replied, it is not truly null and void. We pretend it's null and void. And it was according to him that which was given is truma, since halachically it's valid, it has to be given to the Kohen. He'll use it as fuel. But we'll pretend that nothing happened and you have to redo it. Is null and void effect of making the remainder fit for use? In other words, you can't use the remainder unless, again, another truma is taken. But that which has been set apart becomes truma. That we're not revoking. said, so Rav Chisda says, really the Rabbonin have the power, that's Oker Dover Menator, to uproot that which is in the Torah. Said Rabbi Rav Chisda, according to you, who maintain the act is absolutely null and void, so even the griva, the that which has been designated as truma, returns to its former state of tevel. Tevel means that which has not been tied, or not been, truma has not been taken. The reason being that this is a preventive measure against a possibility. Why did they do this? In other words, why is Rav Chisda of the opinion that we're not going to just say, okay, you have to give that and you have to give another one instead? Because we're afraid of non-compliance. First one's truma, it's okay. I'll forget about the rest. And if we let him get away with it, then he'll continue to do so in the future. So it says, the reason being that this is a preventive measure against the possibility that one might willfully neglect to set apart the truma from the remainder. Is there anywhere, I may ask, is a law that truma, which is valid according to the law of the Torah, should, owing to the possibility that one might willfully neglect his duty, be turned into unconsecrated produce? I mean, how do the Rabbonim have the power to do that? By Torah law, the truma is truma. So how do they have the power to undo that which the Torah itself empowered the person to do? I shouldn't have done it, but it's... Could then a Beis Din lay down a condition that would cause a law of the Torah to be uprooted? And to that Rav Chisda replied, and you do not yourself agree with such a ruling? And he kept on quoting sources, which were contested, pointing to the fact that the Beis Din truly has this power. Rav Chisda, on hearing the last reply, said to Rabba, it was my intention to raise objections against your view that the Beis Din cannot uproot a Torah law from the following rabbinical laws. He quotes six rabbinical laws. One, the law which relates to the uncircumcised convert, you know, that if he converts prior to Passover, we consider him tameh, we consider him to be ritually impure, and he has to wait as if he touched a dead body, and he has to go through the process of purity of 7 days, even though by Torah law he's perfectly pure and should bring a Korban Pesach if it happened right before Pesach, we don't let him. Due to Rebbe, cannot immediately bring the Pesach sacrifice, and yet the Rabbanan intervened and prevented him from bringing the Korban Pesach from the Paschal lamb. Two, and again, the sprinkling of waters, again, which is a similar thing, there's a fear of, and as part of the Tyra, the purification process, is to be sprinkled with the special water that has this intermixed with it, the ashes of the Porah Aduma, of the red heifer. This is on the third day of his touching the dead body, and the seventh day. If the seventh day falls out on Shabbos, or third day, whatever it is, it falls out on Shabbos, you know, we don't let them do this. Because we're afraid, just like carrying a lulav on Shabbos or a shofar on Shabbos, we don't let the sprinkling occur. I was afraid maybe he's going to take it, we take it out. But if that's the case, it may be, he says, that this will interfere with his bringing a Korban Pesach. Because if it's not done the right day, he can't become Tohar. And yet the Rabbanu says, even in that situation, we do not let the sprinkling, the Hazor, occur. There's a case of a knife. You forgot in a situation where there's no Eruv, and you forgot the knife to perform the Zemel, to perform the Bris Milah. We don't let you carry the knife to perform the Bris Milah. There's no Eruv. Even if it would be a rabbinical, it's going through a Karmelist, which is only rabbinically forbidden. Hamidah Devrayim, he says that they said that we forbid you to have, to carry, and therefore forbid you to make the bris. So again, they're annulling a law of the Torah. Again, just the case of the linen cloak, the halacha is quickly that a four-cornered garment, whether it be wool or linen, is required to have tzitzis. Rabbinically, for various considerations around the time, they said that it is free, that one does not put tzitzis on a linen garment. And again, they, according to Torah law, one's required to do so, and they said the one doesn't. This says five is the blood of the Lamb of Shavuos, that Kivsi Atzeres, that there are their special korbanos, which are brought, so sacrifices are brought on Shavuos. So one of them is the Kivsi Atzeres, that there are lambs that are brought on Shavuos. In order for the korban to be considered the valid, as the to fulfill the requirement, it has to be done lishma for its proper sake. It was done shloi. It was whatever it was. They brought this for a different reason. They thought it was an ola, whatever they wanted to make it an ola, or they thought it was an ola. If it's no longer valid, even though it's still kosher, we don't want the kohanim to put the blood on the mizbeach. Because Shabbos, we don't want them to do this. But if they don't put on the blood on the mizbeach, the korban will have to be burned. And by Torah law, you're still required to do so. They had their considerations and they prevented them from doing so. And the last things, of course, was the shofar, which is on Shabbos, not blown on Shabbos, or the lulav is not taken on Shabbos. So he had all these objections. You see that they intervened, Rabbanan, into Torah law. Now, however, that you taught us, and this is Rabbah taught, this is Rav Chisda saying, that Shev al Tasa, abstention from the performance of act, is not regarded as abrogation of the law. I have nothing to say since all these cases are abstention. In other words, they're not really, there's a question how this works, but one school of thought is, they really are not uprooting the Torah law. They just prevented a competing law that says you're not allowed to take this. And therefore, if I'm on one hand, the Torah law says you have to do this, and the competing law says, well, you're not allowed to do this, I'm just stuck. And therefore, Shev al Tasa, therefore I'm passive. But it isn't that they uprooted the law itself. This is one way of understanding this. But again, it continues on. Come in here. You shall hearken to the prophet, even if he tells you transgress any of all of the commandments of the Torah, except the idolatry. As in the case of Eliyahu on Mount Carmel. When the Beis HaMikdash is standing, you're not allowed to bring sacrifices outside the Beis HaMikdash, outside the temple. Eliyahu HaNavi, in Mount Carmel, says, brought a korban. Says, brought a korban ola. He brought a korban. Says, a sacrifice outside of the Beis HaMikdash. This is Eliyahu HaNavi. It was the time of the first Beis HaMikdash. The first Beis HaMikdash was in existence 410 years. He happened to be in the northern kingdom. But in the southern kingdom, and the Beis HaMikdash was functioning. And you're not allowed to bring any korbanos, any sacrifices, as long as the Beis HaMikdash is standing. I mean, the truth is, la halacha, according to the Rambam, even the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. From that point on, that is the sacred area, and no sacrifices can be brought, even today. I mean, you just can't. So it says, this is, as in the case of Eliyahu Carmel, this is obey him in every respect according with the needs of the hour. In other words, we're told to hearken to the prophet. Well, but the prophet is telling you to violate one of the laws of the Torah. Evidently, that his power supersedes the laws of the Torah. On that, Rabbah replied, that's different. Because there's a specific commandment. For it's written, you shall hearken to the prophet. So to this, the Gemara countered, then let rabbinic law be deduced from it. We know that a Navi is not allowed to change any of the laws of the Torah. He can't say there's a new mitzvah, or Hashem said there's a mitzvah no longer exists. He can't do that. Elam mitzvahs, these are the mitzvahs that can't be changed. All a Navi could do is temporarily suspend it. But if that's the power of the Navi, and it's not considered a violation of the Torah, evidently it must be that the Rabbonim also have an equivalent power. And that's how the Gemara reasons. When Eliyahu and Har Carmel, he did it that moment. Right? That's all. Afterwards, not. Yeah. It's going to be clear. Then it says, let rabbinic law be deduced from it. So the Gemara responds, it's true that there is such a power. Even Rabba agrees that they do have, under circumstances, the power to abrogate the laws of the Torah. But only under extreme circumstances. The safeguarding of a cause is different. Migdor milsum. In other words, otherwise they would fall to idolatry. There was an emergency situation. It isn't the same kind of emergency we said before about the truma, about taking the truma. You know, it isn't something which is we're facing the spiritual destruction of the Jewish people. In such a case, the laws of the Torah may be temporarily abrogated. Come and hear. Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov said, there's another case. I heard that even without any specific Torah authority for their rulings, Bezdin may administer flogging and death penalty. Not, however, for the purpose of transgressing the words of the Torah, but in order to make offense for the Torah. And it once happened that a man rode on horseback on Shabbos, the days of the Greeks, and was brought before Bezdin and was stoned. Not because he deserved this penalty, it's only a rabbinic prohibition, but because the exigencies of the hour demanded it. And another incident occurred with a man who had relations with his wife under a fig tree in public, and he was brought before Bezdin and flogged. Not because he deserved such a penalty, because the exigencies of the hour demanded it. So you see again that the Bezdin has the power to create legislation which is against the Torah. You can't hit a man. Of course you can't kill a person. But Bezdin was given special powers. And then Rav Chisda reasons, well, if that's the case, then they could perhaps exercise those powers in the case of the truma. When the person, again, separated the truma, that which is Tomei and that which is Torah, which is a violation of Torah law, they negated the whole process. And to this, Rabba replied, Migdor Milsa Shine. Again, to safeguard a cause is different. This was to safeguard the whole Torah. The whole thing will crumble. But if it's not an emergency situation, they do not exercise this power. And this is not, it's not freely given. It's only under certain extreme circumstances. The Rambam explains this further. But I just wanted to say this is the source. When we deal with this Gemara is the source. This is how the Rambam explains this in Mamrim, in the second chapter. Bezdin, the rabbinic court, has the power to uproot even those rabbinic decrees on a temporary basis. We had discussed in the previous lecture that once a rabbinic law is decreed and accepted, has gained acceptance, only a Bezdin court, which is superior both in wisdom and in number, can void the original legislation. Otherwise, it is permanent. So on this, the Rambam writes that Bezdin has the power to uproot even those rabbinic decrees on a temporary basis, even if the Bezdin is inferior to the original Bezdin that instituted the decree. For these decrees are not treated more seriously than the words of the Torah itself, which any basin can uproot temporarily. In what way is this done? If the Bezdin sees it is necessary to strengthen the practice of Judaism and to erect a protective fence in order to prevent the populace from violating the Torah, it can flog and punish in a way which is not mandated by the Torah. They are not allowed, however, to establish such measures for all generations and to declare this to be the normative halacha. Similarly, if the Bezdin sees it as necessary to annul a positive commandment or to violate a negative commandment in order to bring the populace back into the practice of Judaism or to save many of Israel from violating over other commandments, they may do so in accordance with the needs of the hour. Similarly to the way a physician may amputate a hand or a foot in order to save his patient's life, so too can the Bezdin rule at times to temporarily violate some of the commandments in order that the entirety of the Torah remain. This is similar to the statement of the early sages, desecrate one Shabbos to save a person's life in order that the person may keep many Shabbos. It's based on that philosophy. So here they are allowed, or man, to do this, but only temporarily. Now, besides the circumscribed power of being ochre, of uprooting the law, The Besna has a further power vis-a-vis property rights, as we now read here on the bottom of page 3. Rabbi Yitzchak stated, whence is it deduced that Hefker, removing the ownership from the original owner and declaring the property to be ownerless by Beis Din, by the courts, is legal Hefker? And it finds a source for this. And this, but there is a, you can read this yourself, but there is a, there is a tool that the Beis Din has that they could change the ownership. The courts can change the ownership of property. Again, this is another tool that they have. I would like to give a few examples through history, besides those already mentioned, how change was implemented. You can just understand the dynamics of change. So again, we quoted the story of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, that based on testimony, he felt that the earlier generation had made an error. And that's how he allowed Beis Shan. That's not by uprooting, that's really relying on the testimony of how Rabbi Meir ruled. There's the means of Oker Doverman HaTorah. Under extreme circumstances, Allah, they have the right to uproot the laws of the Torah. And it's basically, la halacha, it's only temporarily, not on a permanent basis. And also the use of hefker, bes, and hefker at times, that they can declare one's property or change, ownerless, or change the ownership. What? Yeah, so we discussed that before. The next is, which is widely quoted, is the case of Prusbel. And this is taken from a Gemara in Lama Devov in Gittin. It says Tanahot Prusbel says Eina Mishamet. This is that the Hillel instituted a law that normally on the seventh year the Torah describes there's a Shemitah. There's a release of the power to collect loans. If afterwards the person wants to still feels a moral obligation to pay back his loan, it's really something which is commendable. But it has to be made clear that he's not giving because he has a legal obligation, but rather a moral obligation. And the person, the creditor has to say, Mishamadani, this is that I'm releasing I have no legal power, and the person afal pi kein, even so, I feel a moral obligation. Then it's given. Hillel instituted a procedure by which legally a person can collect his loan. Right? It's in front of a Beis Din, basically it's giving them the right to collect the loan. He relieves himself from collecting the loan. He's saying, I'm giving the courts the right to collect the loan. So this is the mission. It says Hillel instituted the Prusbel. We have learned elsewhere, Prusbel prevents the remission of debts in the sabbatical year. This is one of the regulations made by Hillel the Elder. For he saw that people were unwilling to lend money to one another, disregarded the precept laid down in the Torah, beware that there not be a thought in your wicked heart, saying the seventh year, the year of release is at hand, and your eye be evil against your poor brother, and you give him nothing, and he cried to the Lord against you, and be sin to you. Now there's a person should... He's afraid to give the loan, even though it's collectible before the end of the seventh year. And he, in theory, could get his money back, but he's still afraid, and therefore, since he doesn't, it's an aver, it's a sin. He therefore decided to institute the Prusbel, because people just were violating this, and were not loaning money to the poor. And the poor were desperate. So he created a means to how the poor could be able to get their loans. The poor can get their loans from the wealthy people, and the wealthy people would not feel that they'd be just throwing away their money. The text of the Prusbel is as follows: I hand over to you, so and so, the judges, such a place, my bonds, you know, the loans, so I may be able to recover any money says owing to me from so and so at any time I shall desire. And the Prusbel was to be signed by the judges or witnesses. That's the principle. Now the Gemara asks the question, is it possible that where according to the Torah, the seventh year releases, and then Hillel should ordain that it should not release? How could he do such a thing? Now, basically, again, is the question is, there's Torah law. What power did Hillel have to institute the principle? That's the Gemara's question. Abaye said he was dealing with the sabbatical year in our time, which was only rabbinical. And he went on the principle laid down by Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, as had been taught, Rabbi said, is written, that now this is the matter of the Shemitah, release, every creditor shall release. It really, the word Shemitah is repeated there. And we saw that really it's hinting at this law of Shemitah, the seventh year of release, is part of the general laws of Shemitah, which apply to the agricultural. The text indicates there are two kinds of Shemitah. Release, the release of land, the other release of money. When the release of land is in operation, the release of money is to be operative. When the release of land is not operative, the release of money is not to be operative. And according to this, during the Second Temple period, Eretz Yisrael did not have the sanctity mandated by the Torah, and therefore the Shemitah on the 70 was not mandated. There's a question, is it because it's dependent on Yovel, and the Jubilee year demands that most of the Jews are in Israel. At that time, that was not the case. Or is it because it's simply because the original Kedusha was not affected, and there was no on the second, and it was never really, by Torah law, was really not introduced. Whatever it is, according to Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, Shemitah in Eretz Yisrael is only rabbinical. And therefore, according to Rebbe, since in agricultural it is only rabbinical, therefore the release is also only rabbinical. So since it was only rabbinical law anyway to be released, he negated the rabbinic law, Hillel. It's not clear, one could well argue that Hillel and Shammai and their disciples were a Bezdin that was superior perhaps to the original Bezdin that legislated this, and it could very well be that was not, the Gemara doesn't deal with that as a problem. The Gemara deals with a different problem. It says as follows. The rabbis have ordained it, again, I'm just repeating, ordained it should be operative in order to keep alive the memory of the sabbatical year. And when Hillel saw that people refrained from lending money, finally he decided to institute the principle. Now the Gemara is asking a question about the legislation to release. But is it possible that where according to the Torah, the seventh year does not release, the rabbis should ordain that it does release? Why are they interfering with the laws of the Torah? Abai replies, it is a case of sit still and do nothing. It's Sheval Tasa. Here they're basically relieving the person of paying the debt. And that they have the power to do. In other words, the Torah law would mandate there's no Shemitah year. But now rabbinically, so they really forbade the person to press his debt. And therefore thereby ending the debt. So passively, they say you have the power to abrogate a law of the Torah, such as the taking of lulav on Shabbos. This is the same thing. Rava replied, the rabbis have power to expropriate for the benefit of the public, hefker based in hefker. They're using, they're exercising another right of theirs, which is the right of property. And again, they took away the person's right to exercise the right to collect the loan. There is a question, this is the Tosfos here, there's a question between Rashi and Tosfos as to what exactly, when Rava said about the exercising of Hefker, Bez, and Hefker, was he referring just to this last question, how do the rabbis create a law to release the During the period when the laws of Shemitah do not apply, but there's a rabbinic Shemitah, how do they have the right to do so? A person has a requirement to pay his debts. So that's It's coming, that's how this Tosfos says, it's the power that they're doing so is actually through Hefker, Bez, and Hefker. This last, basically it's the last question. Last question is, how did the Rabbonim create a law during a period when the laws of Shemitah by Torah law do not apply, and the person has the power to collect his debt afterwards? Now they say he cannot collect his debt. So Abaye said, Shelval Tasa, they can do it in a way when one is passive. And Rava says, Hefker, Bez, and Hefker, they have the rights of property, and that they therefore took away the rights of the creditor to press his debt. Rashi learns that the answer, Hefker, Bez, and Hefker, this answer is really for the original question. Even if I maintain that they're Shemitah min HaTorah, Hizman HaZeh, and right now by Torah law, says it is released, the Prusbel gives him the right to press the debt because what they did is recreated a new debt. The Torah released it, and Hefker Bez and Hefker says, well, the Torah released you, the Rabbanan now put on a new debt that now you have to pay even after the Shemitah. So the Hefker Bez and Hefker is the rights of property, reinstitute a new debt. That's a question of how to understand what the Gemara is saying. There happens to be another way that Tosfos deals with is explaining this whole Gemara, is that the Prusbel works, the handing over my debt to the courts to press is really valid according to Torah law. This is an option according to Torah law. The prohibition is I can't press the debt, me being the one who's collecting. But I give it over to the courts, it's out of my hands already, it's up to the courts to collect. At that point, even by Torah law, then the debt is collectible. As long as it was given over before the seventh year, the debt is collectible. The Gemara's question is, but it's a loophole. It's not in the spirit of the Torah. By doing this, you're just abrogating the common use of this. The Torah, the spirit of the Torah is that you should release your debts. People should say it's the seventh year. And now they're creating this loophole. Why did they do so? And that's how Tosfos learned.
Saying that they cannot collect the debt.
Yeah, normally. So they created a loophole where you could collect the debt. So
the
you should
is the Prusbel.
Is the Prusbel. And according to Tosfos, it works according to Torah law. It wasn't that Hillel created this Prusbel, but it says since it's a loophole, it should not have been made public. This is how the Tosfos thing. There are other things. Let me just go quickly over this. Just touch upon this. There's a law that there's a question. If you didn't find you found a dead body, you don't know who the murderer is. There's a whole ceremony of the Egla Rufa of the breaking of the heifer's neck, the Egla Rufa. The Bezdin stopped doing this at the time when murders were rife. And the reason is because they really knew who the murderers were. They just couldn't go after them. The murders, the multiplied, the seven was discontinued because there was no doubt, you know who they were. They stopped, the Sanhedrin moved from its rightful place, part of the temple complex. There was a Lishkos Hagozos, there was a room for them. This is by the temple. And they moved from there to a place on the Temple Mount, outside the temple itself, called Chanuyos. They did this 40 years before the destruction of the temple, because as long as the Beis Din HaGadol, the Sanhedrin, is part of the temple complex, then all of the lower courts also, it and all the lower courts can deal with capital cases. It's as if the Shechina is imparting its wisdom to the higher court and to the lower courts. Once they leave and they're no longer, the whole court system is not valid dealing with capital crimes. And they did this and they stopped adjudicating capital cases.
Why?
Because there were so many murders and they couldn't bring them to justice because of the Romans were in charge. And their taija, it was a mockery of the whole system. They said they left it to the Romans. They just stopped. But I'm just saying that there were changes. I just want to show that there were changes based on, but again, the changes were through the normative laws of the Torah. They were not, there were very rarely do we have these changes that are dramatic. I mean, a dramatic one is killing someone who rides a horse on Shabbos. You know, but it's a rarity. Most of them, this are using the laws of the Torah itself. There was a change, the sota. There's the whole ceremony of the woman who was a suspect. In the time of Yochanan ben Zakkai, and the temple was still standing, he stopped this. And the reason he did was because, you can read this, that it only works if the husband himself is morally correct. If he himself has been engaged in immoral acts, or his family has and he has tolerated it, he's not worthy of this miracle of sustaining the marriage. He's an immoral person. Immorality became common, and he said it's just not going to work then. So therefore he stopped it. And then the final, you know, example, which is an interesting example. Just give me a little background of this. When a woman gives birth, she has to bring a korban. She has to bring a sacrifice. If she has five births, the temple was built in Mizr Hashem, there are five korbanos. There's two parts to this. One is this requirement to bring a korban. One has to bring a sacrifice. There's the other one that until she brings that sacrifice, she cannot eat kodeshim, she cannot eat the holy food, she can't walk into the temple complex. She's tum, she's called a muhusar kippurim, she's lacking atonement. So she has a requirement because of the mitzvah, and it has ramification vis-a-vis her eating, she can't bring a korban pesach, for instance, because she can't eat the paschal lamb, it's kodeshim. It's a sacrificial food. If let's say a woman had five births, and she brought for one of them, that would cleanse her, that would be sufficient, even though she still has to bring the other four, but that would be enough for her to be considered cleansed, and she can eat the sacrificial food, so that she could walk into the temple complex, so she's not tomei anymore. There's a residual tumah, there's an initial tumah in cleansing when a person gives birth. It is totally eradicated, this tumah, only when that korban is brought. But if she had five births, one korban would suffice as well. But she still has to bring the other four, because
Why didn't she bring that one korban after she had all five.
Let's say she brought just one.
After she had all five,
and then she brought one. She's going to bring the other four, but she just brought one. At that point, she's cleansed. She can eat from the paschal lamb. But she still has a chiv. She has a requirement to bring. Every birth has it's a hoidah, baruch Hashem. You know, you have a child. You're healthy. It is. You bring the korban. But it's, so that it has two parts to this. You know, very often, you know, if the Beis HaMikdash would be built right now, and all of the people who had, all the women who have children, and they know how many children they've had, will go now bring korbanos. Now, for one who is wealthy, says they bring a lamb, for instance, and a bird for the, you know, either a pigeon, a dove, you know, a tor, there's a ben yoina, they bring, says one is for the ola, and one is for a chatas. If they're poor, both, they bring two birds. One for an ola, one for a burnt offering, one for a chatas, one for a sin offering. Imagine, says, what the price of, I don't know how many doves are being raised right now. Let's say, says you have, imagine how many Jewish women will come now to the Beis HaMikdash and will want doves. The price will go sky high. This is Adam Smith, supply and demand. Now, you have, just as we have like the oil cartel, you have a prayer that very often the sellers can get together and say, you know what, this is our price. You don't like it. There's no other place to go. How do you combat a cartel? Well, one way it says, we don't need your product anymore. So this is the basis here on page 6, paragraph D. It once happened in Jerusalem, the price of a pair of doves rose to a golden dinar, which is the equivalent of 25 silver dinars. Said Rav Shimon ben Gamliel, by this sanctuary, and it's like he was making an oath, I shall not go to sleep tonight before the cost is but a silver dinar. Because it was a tremendous imposition on the people. You have to realize that the, people, most of the people didn't have the money for this. Then he entered the Beis Din and taught, if a woman had five certain births or five certain issues, you know, this is Zivos, which is a woman has menstrual blood, but not at the time of the menses, which is then there was some, associated with some sort of a abnormality. She only needs to bring one offering and may then eat the sacrificial food. She is not bound to bring the other offerings. Basically, he relieved the women of their Torah requirement to bring the other offerings. That is the one she needs to become cleansed. But the other, which she's required by Torah law, he went to the Bez, which is the Sanhedrin. Shimon Gamliel was the head of the Sanhedrin, and they ruled, they relieved the people, you don't have to bring it anymore. This was a temporary relief, which Shimon Gamliel and his Bez an issue. Thereupon, the price of a pair of birds stood at a quarter of a silver dinar. They had all got all of this, you know, based on the projection of their... They had all of these birds now that would not be sold. And each one was vying for the other, and it drove the price down. This is Adam Smith. It drove the price down. This is capitalism at its finest. But this has this particular instance, this ruling really is, amongst everything that we've learned, has practical application today. Which takes you now on D, but number 2. If those who sell fish is always, even Jews who couldn't afford anything, have fish on Shabbos. Those who sell fish raise the price. And again, they're raising the price not because, fairly, because they don't, just there's not enough of a supply. They have a supply, but it's a cartel. They come together and let's just raise the price. It is proper for a community to issue a temporary ordinance forbidding the purchase of fish until the price returns to the norm. So from now on, there's no fish. So if all of these fish merchants have all this supply, which so he says, listen, unless it comes down, we're not buying anything. I mean, you see, this is really the tension here between the unions and the same type of a. This is really. You know, we have two groups here. Remember when, with Cesar Chavez, had a thing about the lettuce. So there's the power of the consumer. Behold, the Berhetev and the Primogodim quote a source that the community should not issue such an ordinance unless the price was raised more than a third over the norm. The El Yarab and the Primogodim, however, so wrote that such measures should be taken even when the price rose less than a third because of the hardship that increased prices pose for the destitute. So we find this, that there's a, but then it's Shev Baltasa. This is not what there kind of is, and it's only, of course, temporary. And now finally, before we go into detail regarding the changes that were suggested by the Reform Rabbinic Assemblies, I would first like to touch upon the historical attitudes regarding the sacrifices one is required to make in order to preserve the integrity of the Torah. This more than anything gives us an insight into the horror felt by the traditional rabbinate towards the suggestions of the Reform Rabbinical Assembly and their reaction towards the members of the Reform Assembly. And here we have on the bottom of page 6, Mesiras Nefesh, self-sacrifice to fulfill mitzvahs. And I quote now from the Shulchan Aruch and Yoredei Kuf Nun Zion, 157.1. In a situation where a person is threatened with death, if he does not commit a certain sin, if the violation occurs in private, he may commit the sin in order to prevent his death. This rule applies to any of the commandments of the Torah with the exception of idolatry, immorality, adultery and incest, and spilling of blood. The gloss of Rav Moshe Israelish. If he can save himself by giving the other party all of his possessions, he must do so in order to avoid violating a negative commandment. In other words, there's a heser of pikuach nefesh, to save a life, one violates a negative commandment, except for the three cardinal sins. First it says, if you're not machal Shabbos, I'm going to just take away all your possessions. You can't be machal Shabbos. This is not the basis to allow you to be machal Shabbos. Now, we continue on top of page 7, the Shach writes there, it says, in order to avoid violating a negative commandment. Regarding a positive commandment, even if the mitzvah is time sensitive, one is not required to give up more than a fifth of one's income in order to fulfill it. In other words, that person, whatever it is, a person is really not required to do more than giving a fifth of one's income. The only exception is really when it comes to the candles for Hanukkah, or the four cups of wine for Pesach, which is Persume Nisa, which is publicizing the miracle. And then even one does not have the money, one is required to borrow, to beg, to work extra hours, whatever it is, to get the money in order to pay for the mitzvah. But otherwise, if you don't have the money, it's only according to a fifth of one's income. Beyond that, one is not required to do a positive commandment. But a negative commandment, to violate a negative commandment, one is required to, one has no heter. One has no, money itself is not, life is a consideration and not money. B, if this would occur in public, in the presence of 10 Jews, one is obligated to let himself be killed rather than sin. This rule is only applicable in the situation where the intention of the Gentile is to force the Jew to violate his religious principles. In the case where the Gentile's motivation is strictly for his own pleasure, then the Jew should commit the sin rather than be killed. If, however, it is a time when there is a governmental decree to assimilate Jewry, one is required to give up his life, even when one is being forced to change something as minor as a Jewish custom as regarding to a shoelace. There was a certain way that Jews had, particularly because it's the modesty, whatever, how they wore their shoelaces, and the Gentiles, the Goyim, wanting to assimilate the Jews, wanted to change that custom, they would have to be required to give up their life even for that. And then it says, finally, in regard to idolatry and morality, adultery is an incest, and spilling of blood, even if this crime would occur in private, in the absence of a governmental decree, and even if the Gentile's only intention, fulfillment of his own pleasure, nevertheless one must let himself be killed in order to avoid violating the law. This applies to any prohibition linked to these sins, even for those crimes where the penalty is not death, but just a simple admonishment. In other words, just as an example, prostrating oneself before an idol, sacrificing before an idol is a crime punishable by death. But washing the idol, kissing the idol, like showing, which is endearment, without worship is forbidden, is a law. For that also, it's a negative prohibition, but does not carry the death penalty, but even for that, one is required to give up his life. Nonetheless, even in those situations, one is required to give his life rather than sinning. So just to give you a sense of how the seriousness the halacha views in keeping the mitzvahs. Yeah, that's a really is a there's a question, where's the fifth? There's definitely a Takonis Chachamim about a fifth, and then Subas Mem Tes, there's Yerushalmi's Halacha Moshe Mishinai. Now, in a previous lecture, we covered the first of the Reform Rabbinic Assemblies in Brunswick, or Braunschweig, in the year 1844, which brought together some 25 Reform-minded rabbis or preachers for a period of 8 days. The next year, the assembly took place in Frankfurt and attracted 31 attendees and lasted for 14 days. In a previous lecture, we already touched upon the controversy between Dr. Zacharias Frankel and the majority of the conference in Frankfurt regarding the usage of Hebrew language in the service and ultimately regarding the whole pace of the Reformation of Judaism. It was Frankel's contention that any reforms have to be validated by the sentiments of the whole of Jewry and cannot merely be instituted on high by a reform-minded rabbinate. It was this idea of the will of the people, that the will of the people defines the pace of reform, that most clearly separated Frankel from his reform colleagues. It is interesting to note that in a different context, we do find that Jewish people as a whole are the recipients of divine inspiration. As we read here in the bottom of page 7, it says, this is the story when Hillel, he's already 80 years old, had come up from Bavel, who was a leading scholar. He had studied under Shmaya of Aptalion of a previous generation. He came up to Bavel. He came from Bavel. He came to Eretz Yisrael and had to bring a Korban Pesach. There was a question there about what happens when Pesach falls out on Shabbos. And the B'nai B'Seira that were the leadership there did not know. But Hillel explained to them, taught them, that Pesach, Korban Pesach, has a precedence even over Shabbos. And seeing his superiority in learning, they crowned him to be the Nasi, the head of the Sanhedrin. But after they had crowned him, it says, the B'nai B'Seira, the leadership of the Sanhedrin prior to Hillel, asked Hillel, "Master, what if a man forgot, did not bring a knife to the temple to slaughter the Korban Pesach?" The personal Passover sacrifice, which is scheduled brought on Shabbos, on the day before Shabbos. He didn't bring it the day before Shabbos to the temple complex. They couldn't carry Yerushalayim. Tosas explains that they had really, I guess because they were, the Romans really had made that the walls of Jerusalem really were full of major gaps. So really you could not carry, like it had lost the power of being a Rishus HaYofet anymore. It no longer was considered a private area because all of the gaps in the wall. So they couldn't carry, there was no error, they couldn't carry on Shabbos. They had forgotten to bring the knives to the temple complex before Shabbos. So what should they do? He says, "I've heard this law answered, but I've forgotten it. But leave it to Israel. If they are not prophets, they're the children of prophets. The name of them are disciples of prophets. On the morrow, says he was Passover sacrifice was a lamb, stuck it, the knife in its wool. It was Passover sacrifice was a goat, stuck it in between its horns. Hillel saw the incident, recollected the halacha, and said, Thus I received permission from the mouths of Shmaya and Aptalion that they are allowed to, normally on a regular Shabbos, you wouldn't be allowed to do this. But for the Korban Pesach, you'd be allowed to do this. And as he remembered, it says that this is what they did. And he relied on their instinctive feelings that they would do the right thing. So there is a place for the feelings of the people, but it's very limited. Dr. Frankel expounded on this idea to say, it says that the religious sentiment of the entirety of the Jewish people defines what halachas are still in force, what halachas should be abandoned. We had quoted before, the previous lecture, says the words of Dr. Frankel, just at the beginning of it, until a few decades ago, Judaism had for a long period been a state of total immobility. It satisfied the people, and therefore the teachers did not have the right to introduce reforms, even if they had been able to transcend their age. The great gap between yesterday and today has still not been bridged, and the will of our people is still firmly rooted in the past. As long as this will be still, this will still pulsates strongly. We cannot and will not touch it. Rather, it must be the desire of our teachers to gain the confidence of the people by leading them gently so that ultimately they may be granted the right to reform. This reform is something that if the people so desire, they can make the change. This sentiment was also echoed by Dr. Solomon Schechter, the architect of American conservative Judaism. To quote Dr. Schechter, quote, "The center of authority is," and he continues, "placed in some living body which," and continues, "is best able to interpret the nature of its," the Bible's, "secondary meaning. This living body, however, is not represented by any corporate priesthood or rabbihood, but by the collective conscience of Catholic Israel." The word Catholic here means universal or comprehensive, as equivalent to the term Klal Yisrael, the community of Israel. It is self-evident that this is really a new theology that bears only a superficial resemblance to the previous quoted Gemara in Pesachim. It is also based upon their view of positive historic change, that the corpus of halacha has undergone changes throughout the generations based upon the changing will of the people, a notion that runs counter to the source material of the Talmud, and is in truth based upon Frankel's and Schechter's critical and quote-unquote scientific view of the history of the composition of the oral law. The traditional Talmudic view is the oral law was part of the law that was given to Moses. It wasn't something created by the Jewish people. Because according to them that we went through, that his view is very different. But even if we would grant prophetic powers to Catholic Israel, such prophecy is strictly limited to the tzaddikim, the saintly, those of high moral rectitude, who are worthy of such prophecy. We say they're b'nei nevi'im. They are the disciples, the children of the Nevi'im. As we see in the following quote from the Gemara in Sota here. So the Gemara says, Rechizda said at first before Israel sinned, again, this is against morality, the Shekhinah, the divine presence, abode with each individual. As it said, the Lord your God walks in the midst of your camp. When they sinned, the Shekhinah departed from them, as it says, that he see no unclean thing in you and turn away from you. You can't assume when the people themselves are not pure that they will have this instinctive divine revelation of doing the right thing. Dr. Frankel's exit from the Frankfurt Rabbinic Assembly did not seriously disrupt the assembly, and it continued on to discuss the basic issues of the coming of Mashiach and the return to Tzion. After serious discussion, the majority decided, quote, the messianic idea deserves a significant role in our prayers, but the petitions for a return to the land of our fathers and the establishment of a Jewish state should be eliminated from them, end quote. Now, since the majority of the rabbis attending this assembly no longer believed in the divinity of either the written or oral law, nor did they embrace the national aspects of the Jewish people, as the Zionist movement would do 50 years later, these rabbis had to now find a new focus for Judaism that would distinguish it from liberal Christianity. The focus that these rabbis found for their basically new German Jewish religion was an aspect of traditional Judaism that had not, up until that point, been seriously stressed, although the existence had foundations in classic Judaic literature. This was the idea of the mission of Israel. Ludwig Philipson, the rabbi of Magdeburg, formulated this at the Assembly of Brunswick, and he quotes, I quote, "Every people has its mission in history. The Jews, too, have their mission. They are the people of religion," end quote. David Einhorn, a radical reformer, expressed this idea at the Frankfurt Assembly in the following manner, quote, "The collapse of Israel's political independence was once regarded as a misfortune. But it really represented progress, not atrophy, but an elevation of religion. Henceforth, Israel came closer to its destiny, holy devotion replaced sacrifices. Israel was to bear the word of God to all corners of the earth." End quote. Although this idea did not originate with them, it did become the cornerstone of their newfound faith. Let us now touch upon some of the sources that support this idea. Here, on page 8, we speak about the mission of Israel. This is the first clause in Parshas Yisro, it says in Shmos Yutes, in Exodus 19. Now therefore, if you obey my voice indeed and keep my covenant, then you shall be my own treasure among all peoples, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words which you'll speak to the people of Israel. And the Sephorno explains his understanding is, for you shall be a kingdom of priests to give understanding and guidance to the entire human race, so they will call together in God's name and serve him in unity. In other words, he understands that the kingdom of priests is a mandate for Jews to interact with the world at large. And there's the pasuk in Yeshaya in chapters, Membeis in chapter 42. I, the Lord, have called you in righteousness and will hold your hand and will keep you and give you a covenant of the people for a light to the nations, to open the blind eyes, to bring out the prisoners from the prison, those who sit in darkness out of the prison house. But through the Jews that will enlighten the nations. And the Gemara says, the Gemara in Pesachim, in Pezayin and Mabez in 87b, the Holy One, blessed be, he's only exiled Israel amongst the nations in order that proselytes may join them. That's why the punishment was, as Marsha says, we could be punished within being in Israel, the land of Israel itself. But we're scattered in order to have an effect upon the nations. For it is said, and I will sow her unto, like Zareah, I will sow, plant her unto me in the land. Surely a man sows a saw in order, one bushel, in order to harvest many kor. A kor equals 30 saw. In other words, we were scattered amongst the nations to bring spirituality to the nations. And, you know, and finally, says the Jewish existential philosopher Solomon Ludwig Steinheim, expressed the same idea in the following manner. Each individual member of this people, as long as he has not solemnly separated himself and voluntarily excluded himself from its community, accepts his share in the great mission of dispersion. But it's a mission. And this is how the Reform movement looked at this. As we're going to explain with Shamsham Frol Hirsch, he really stresses this. But of course, the Jews now are our light to the nation, acting following the Torah.
So there's nothing wrong with looking at it as a mission. It's just how you go about it.
How are you going about it? Now, other reforms were voiced, says, in the Frankfurt Assembly. It was decided unanimously to eliminate the prayers for the restoration of the Karbonis sacrifices, although most want to retain their mention as historical memory. The rabbis of Frankfurt also voted in favor of a 3-year cycle for reading the Torah instead of the widespread custom of 1-year cycle. In addition, they voted that the Haftorah be said in German. I mean, these were things that were done in other congregations across Germany, but they really wanted to create a unified, you know, reform. Furthermore, they decided almost unanimously that an organ should play on Shabbos even by a Jew. One very interesting decision that they made was regarding a question that came before them regards to a communal mikveh in the city of Bingen that was not being used because of its filth. The questioners asked the assembly if it would be permissible for them to use the mayim she'uvim, drawn waters of natural spring or rainwater, to be used in the mikveh. Although it's clearly stated in the Mishnah, Talmud, Shulchan Aruch, the mayim she'uvim, the drawn water, renders a mikveh invalid, posel, the rabbinic assembly permitted it. It is ironic, though, that although the assembly seems to have advocated in some form the use of a mikveh, a short time later, the community of Frankfurt, under the leadership of Dr. Leopold Stein, the chairman of the Frankfurt Rabbinic Assembly, closed down their own community's mikveh. It was only through the efforts of the breakaway Orthodox community in Frankfurt, led by Rav Shamsham Frol Hirsch, that a new mikveh in Frankfurt was constructed. The assembly also turned down a request by a physician that circumcision be either totally abandoned or greatly modified. It seems that even after Frankel's departure, so they weren't ready to totally abandon Jewish ritual. The issue of Shabbos observance in the face of the challenge of modernity was taken up in the final rabbinic assembly that was held the next year in Breslau under the leadership of its chief rabbi, the Reform ideologue, Dr. Abraham Geiger. There were 26 attendees in Breslau, and the session lasted for 12 days. One of those pressing issues surrounded Shabbos. Now, because of the time, I just can't go into the all of the drushes that were given. But what they voted was, and they stressed the need, of course, to preserve its sanctity in the home and create a more meaningful, edifying service in the Reformed temple. But to make it that much easier, they declared a situation where complete rest would infringe upon one's livelihood, the prohibition of Amir L'Akram telling a non-Jew to do prohibited work, something which is explicitly prohibited by the Talmud and Shulchan Aruch, would now be relaxed. So in addition, they voted that in a situation where one's entire possession property would be destroyed, where the means for future livelihood would be threatened, in which case, again, the Talmud and Shulchan Aruch rules that one is nonetheless still required to refrain from doing work, the assembly voted to relax that rule so that one personally would be allowed to violate the Sabbath. The assembly also did away with Eruve Chatzeres, the rabbinic prohibition of caring from privately owned domain to a commonly owned domain, such as from a private apartment to the apartment's house, you know, common courtyard. So we have, as we discussed last time, that there's an Erev, in other words, that there's a commonly owned food for all the residents. They did away with this. There's also this date from the time of Shlach King Solomon. They also did away with Eruvei Tchumen, as of the 2,000 cubits boundary. Regarding soldiers serving the military, the assembly obliged us all to perform their full military duties and violate the Sabbath. Governmental officials were also relieved of their obligation of Sabbath observance, provided, of course, that the spirit of Sabbath permeated their home. And finally, they proposed the establishment of a societies for the restoration of worthy Shabbos celebrations. One can only imagine influence on the improved Shabbos observance that these proposals affected. They also did away with the second day of Yom Tov.
This was in what year?
This is in 1846. So on the second day, so on the eighth day of Pesach, chametz could be eaten, work could be done. And they said if they meet resistance in their communities, they could still hold special holiday services. They did vote, however, the second day of Rosh Hashanah should be maintained. They also said that if Rosh Hashanah falls out on Shabbos, or the first day of Sukkot falls on Shabbos, the shofar should be blown and the lulav should be taken. Regarding the liturgy, they left it for a committee for the future. They made changes in the Mila. There was no more Priya B'Tzipranayim. There was no, you know, taking off the membrane after the Mila with fingernails. They discontinued Mitzitza, sucking up the blood. They demanded that the medical examination be done before, and the physician be there, you know, to attend the child afterwards. They changed the whole mourning customs. There was no more kriya, there was no more tearing of the clothes. The abstinations of shaving or taking a haircut in the shiva, sitting on the ground, the prohibition of wearing leather footwear to wash or bathe, or to greet acquaintances, this was all, they're all relieved, taken away. No longer they felt this wasn't in, I mean, evidently society as a whole, the German Lutheran society, this was not the custom of mourning. And they did away with this custom of mourning. And again, they changed, because I think there were various in how they changed the, there are various changes that were proposed in committee did not really get to vote in the conference. they felt that both the boy and the girl should start their mitzvahs at 13. There shouldn't be any difference between them, for instance. So the bar mitzvah with bat mitzvah would be 13. This all came from this, from these proposals. There shouldn't be any difference between them in terms of their mitzvahs, their requirement to educate their children, the same men and women. This was in so we discussed there are three rabbinic assemblies. One in Brunswick and Braunschweig in 1844, Frankfurt 1845, says, and now says in 1840 in Breslau. That was the last rabbinic assembly. Because of various internal political issues, the fact is that the people themselves, the people wanted a voice. They just didn't want it to be created just by the rabbis. It did not, there was no assembly for the next 20 years. And then there was really, it was a combination of laity and the rabbis. And it was called a synod instead of an assembly. One was in 1869 in Leipzig, and the other was in Augsburg in 1871. But they basically continued on the process. One interesting thing is, on the whole, the rabbis at attendance of these synods were the same as those as the previous assemblies. Germany was not producing at that time a new generation of Reform rabbis. And Dr. Zachariah Frankel's rabbinic seminary in Breslau, then in 1853, was producing rabbis with a much more traditional orientation. So they did not attend these synods. In addition, due to the influence of such Orthodox leaders as Rav Shamshon Fol Hirsch, Orthodoxy experienced a renaissance in Germany. So you didn't find people who potentially would have been Reform rabbis were just not going towards Reform. So finally, a year after the Augsburg Synod, the Reform Rabbinic Seminary, the Hochschule for the Wissenschaft der Judentum, or College for Jewish Studies, opened their doors in Berlin and proceeded to produce rabbis for Reform pulpits for over the next 70 years, until it was finally closed by the Nazis in 1942. So this ends the first part of this series, the roots of the Reform and Conservative movements and the basis for the Orthodox opposition to these movements. We went through the history as well as we went through discussions, the sources in the Talmud as to about regarding the origin of the oral law, the whole basis for rabbinic legislation, and the basis for any change. I hope at a later date, Amir Sashem, to cover the spread of Reform Judaism in America and the creation of the conservative movement in America. In the next five lectures, I would like to trace the lives and thinking of some of the leading Orthodox Rabbonim during this period of the flowering Reform Judaism and their impact on the course of history. Now, are there any questions?
These rabbis, the people that they serve, do they, under the assumption that this is what a Moshe Rabbeinu would expect Judaism to become, to be like, and it was just a proper evolution? Or was it that they decided they don't want to rest, but they don't want to give up because of feelings of the past?
Yes, your question is, what was their question is, what was their view of their past vis-a-vis the present right now? One can't underestimate in their thinking, what we call the flowering of Bible criticism, where they viewed that, for many of them, viewed that that which was called Mosaic law was not even the product of Moses, and certainly not the product of true prophecy. And they viewed that it was man's changing conception of how to deal with God. And as man's changing conception, perception of how to deal with the spiritual, to deal with God. They viewed that there was a different age, a more primitive age, and that they dealt with in this manner. Now that man has progressed, they felt that there's other ways of expressing one's spirituality. They did not share the belief truly that God had spoken to them and this is what God wanted of them. Otherwise, they would have not, they couldn't have done what they wanted. Many of those who were sympathetic to Dr. Frankel, to Harish Frankel, who believed that God did speak to the Jewish people, and there were mitzvahs that were given. But they also still had to deal with that there was a room for the human expression that kept on changing. They had to give themselves that room in order to justify the changes they wanted to implement. But those who really, whose hashkafa, whose worldview was based on Talmudic tradition of what occurred, could not join this at all.
Yeah. You know, like, the halakhas of mikvah and midah, how did they respond to that?
Again, so they viewed, you're asking about mikvah and midah, where they eventually did away with this totally. They view this was not, basically they view the same way as they viewed sacrifices. It was archaic, it was primitive, it reflected the morals of a different society, and it was not in keeping with the morals of that society. That's how they had to justify. If they would view this is given by Hashem, this is what Hashem wants from them, and this is the Torah, then they could have never done what they did.
So how did that affect marriage, you know, with,
Right, so I don't know, you know, I don't know if it was brought to them, you know, before. I mean, it was, one thing though, which is not, is that divorce was much less common then than it is today. And really the major problems are, if after there's the marriage, there's a divorce, and how do you deal with it? And assuming the divorce was not a halachic divorce, and it was done under the Reform auspices, then how does one deal, and if there was a remarriage,
right,
how does one deal with the children? I'm not aware, you know, of response of them. Right. Yeah, you're asking about how they viewed Shabbos, which is so explicit and repeated so many times in the Torah. They had to find justification, either that the concept of malocha, of work, was something which the rabbis interpreted one way, and we have the right to interpret a different way.
In the 19th century, people were still doing agriculture. I mean, it was the Industrial Revolution. Yeah. There were new things.
Right. But they would. But you know, that was one means of dealing with, to redefine work. What does work mean? And also the notion, the important thing is the spirit, not the minutiae, not the. Samuel Holdheim, one of the leaders of radical reform, really maintained that it would be best to substitute Sunday for Shabbos. It was a 6-day work week. They weren't working on Sunday. Let Sunday be the Shabbos. That was too much of a departure from tradition, and he was a lone voice. But they grappled with this. They knew that they had to maintain some semblance, at least at that period of time, of the traditional Shabbos. They had not made the major changes yet that we have in today's Reform Judaism. Because they're speaking about having a non-Jew do this work. But there was a concept that normally if they didn't need to, they would not themselves do the work. There was still a concept of a halachic Shabbos with many kulos, with many leniencies. That already eventually, if we have the time, you know, we eventually come to how it developed in America. What radical reform did, what totally did away with halacha. But that did not occur yet.
Were they interested in exporting this concept to other countries, or were they focused just on their own Germany?
Yeah, you're asking about exporting. The basic concern, was Germany. The most is Hungary was part of the Austro-Hungarian, so there was part of their But for the most part, they were rabbis in Germany, and they were interested in Germany. It happened to be exported, but that was not the focus.
They weren't trying to proselytize to the rest of the world. They were just trying to accommodate their own people.
Right. It just so happened that most radical of the Reform rabbis happened because of circumstance to come to America. Especially after there was an abortive revolution in 1848. Many of those associated with the revolution were forced to leave, and they came to America. They were the most radical wing, and they eventually took over. So that's where Reform Judaism in America was much less traditional than it was in Germany. You have the Reform in Hungary, what they call the Neologs. In many, it was Reform, and their understanding of the history was the Reform understanding of history. Yet the Neologs were much more traditional than the Reform in America. And if somebody happened to be visiting in Budapest and came to the Reform temple, and he came in, he didn't realize, he came with his wife in a separate seating. His wife was, and the davening was like a regular davening. That's what he said. The only thing is, when they finished chakras and they came to Kriya Satara, then the organ started playing. And the rabbi and the chazan came down from, there was a whole theatrics. And the man nodded to his wife, and they both went, and they went to the other shul. But
he was Orthodox, modern Orthodox.
But he didn't see.
Right, but he didn't. It wasn't evident until the ceremony before Kriya Satira with the organ and the, so they were much more traditional.
Yeah. Was there anything that they held to be sacrosanct that they really, the Shita, wanted to preserve because they felt it was core value of Judaism that really should not be changed?
Well, again, they were maskim really to, they agreed to Shabbos in some form, prayer in some form, because you needed to keep you can't have a valid religion. You know, there had to be some form, but they felt that the form, that the traditional form was too rigid, and they didn't believe it had divine validity in any case. So it was too rigid, and that's where they had to relax it.
But is that because they believed that it had evolved away from its original intent and they were fixing it?
No, I don't believe that they were trying to preserve the original Judaism. They felt the whole idea of Judaism itself was an evolutionary process. I believe it. Okay, a gutter bach.